Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Janet Gotkin about the Santa Fe Women's Film Series, Before There Was Choice. I'm delighted now to welcome Linda Tellington-Jones. She's a trainer and teacher. She's the author of 20 books. She works with animals and with people who love their animals. And she will be teaching a workshop for horses and people starting on the 30th of June here in the Santa Fe area, and then a dog workshop starting on the 6th of July. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It's a delight to be with you.
So you spent what sounds like really a wonderful childhood full of animals of all kinds, and particularly horses. How did you first come across a way of, I don't even know if you want to call it breaking horses, training horses that didn't require domination over them?
Oh, you know what? I was really blessed. I rode to school for the first 6 years of my life in Canada, in Alberta. And then when I was nine, I started riding after school every day at a riding stable in Edmonton, Alberta. And my riding instructor was, you know, a very well-respected woman who broke horses out in the round pen. And I always joke that I'm shorter than my sister because I was bucked on my head so many times. But when I was 12, I was riding home from the stable one day, and this old man hobbled out on a cane carrying a book in his hand, and he said that he had watched me ride by, rain or shine, every day, and he had something for me, and it was a book written by an U.S. cavalry officer on how you start young horses without bucking by ground driving. And within a month, I had started a two-and-a-half-year-old thoroughbred that was boarding at our farm by ground-driving her, and never had fear, no bucking, no trauma. And that started a lifelong process of, I teach people in many, many countries to start their own horses this way without fear or bucking or trauma.
And so the horses end up being trained, but not through fear, and it's a much more harmonious process.
Well, they are shown what it is we want without having to be broken, so to speak. And today it's very different because over the years I've now brought many, many things to this, of course, and now we teach a type of touch on the body called Tellington T-Touch, which is gentle circular touches over every inch of the body that give a horse a new sense of awareness of themselves, a balance, of real capacity to actually go beyond instinct and fear and learn how to think about situations rather than react. And I get the great pleasure of traveling around the world, working in many, many countries. We have actually teachers of the Tellington Method in 29 countries now, teaching people how to be with their horses in this way of coming from the heart and the mind rather than using strength.
One of your formative experiences was you were in a zoo observing a gorilla and just looked at how miserable this animal was. Tell us about that.
Oh, that was such an interesting memory. It was 1973, and it was in the days when zoos had not, you know, made the modern steps that most of them have now, that so many of zoos I now work with have. But she was just terrible, and I photographed her every minute for 60 minutes and made a vow, and that's in my wonderful little paperback called the Tellington T-Touch. I made a vow to her that somehow I would make a difference in zoos, and that zoo today is one of the most progressive, and as a matter of fact, next year they're going to have a 3-acre natural enclosure in Lowlands in Zurich for those gorillas now today. So it really made me aware of how we have to honor the animals that come into our lives. And, you know, many people can't go to zoos, but what I kept doing, and I've had the great privilege of doing, is just bringing the prayer and the thought that we can make a difference and that these animals are important to us. And I don't know how you are with zoos, but I get the privilege of working in many really wonderful zoos in many different parts of the world, and I think we all can hold that and make a difference.
One of the guiding principles of your work and what you learned along the way is that, first of all, we're deeply connected to all the other animal species, and they're not lesser than human beings, and we all really have the ability to communicate with one another in a friendly and cooperative way, including that gorilla, including all these zoo animals that some people think are, I don't know what, like exotic kind of artworks or something, as opposed to being creatures like us.
Yes, and I feel so privileged. I just got back from Jordan working with the Princess Alia Al Hussein Foundation. And Princess Alia is, she's actually the sister of the present king, Abdullah. And she really loves all animals and people, I have to say. I'm a great fan. But she has this organization to look in at areas in zoos or situations where animals aren't doing well. Like, she's taken wolves and that were just doing that stereotypical, you know, pacing that's so awful, just totally stressed out. And I just spent some wonderful time with them, and they are out in a big natural area, and they're very happy wolves now. And she took, actually, five hyenas out of really terrible situations and has released three of them. And anybody who's interested can actually look up the Princess Alia Foundation. And they're wonderful, very inspiring YouTube-like videos that you can see. And it's one of the most deeply touching videos I have ever seen of a hyena female who had been raised in captivity, and she was released for the first time into this huge natural wild area in Jordan. And you see her walking out and stopping and looking with such consciousness that anybody looking at that will realize that animals have a consciousness beyond anything that we ever realized until very recently. Finally, it's being realized, and thanks to YouTube a lot, we're seeing these animals who are really obviously thinking.
Yeah, exactly. We're talking to Linda Tellington-Jones. One of the very important discoveries that you made was of the Feldenkrais method, which is a form of, I guess you would call it, body work that maybe some of our listeners are familiar with. It's definitely taught here in Santa Fe, and you studied with Moshe Feldenkrais himself. Tell us about what you learned in that process and how you applied it to animals.
Well, I was just so blessed. I started doing bodywork on horses in 1960, first of all, 15 years before the Feldenkrais work, because my grandfather, Will Kaywood, had learned a type of equine massage in Moscow from Russian gypsies, where my grandfather had been training at the Hippodrome, in the stable of Tsar Nicholas II. And he brought that form of massage to my husband and myself at our thoroughbred farm. And for all those years, we used massage to help horses recover after hard endurance riding. I did a lot of 100-mile endurance racing and steeplechasing and eventing. But it never crossed my mind that you could actually change the personality or behavior of an animal by working on the body, until I had the great fortune to do a 4-year study with Moshe Feldenkrais at the Humanistic Psychology Institute in San Francisco. And that was in 1975 that I started that training. And in the second day of that, I took the training thinking I was going to use it for my riding students, because I had an international residential school for riding instructors in those days. But in the second day of the training, Moshe Feldenkrais, who was a visionary and a phenomenal human being, he made a statement that actually changed the way I looked at horses after more than 30 years of being a professional. And what he said was that it's possible for a human to learn in one experience using non-habitual, gentle movements that activate unused neural pathways to the brain, so that we can have that new potential, not only for movement, but for more potential for learning, which was really his passion. And when he made that statement on the second day of my four-year training, I thought, wait a minute, if this is true for a human, that has to be true for a horse. And I thought of all the years that I had bought into the what I today see as a myth that horses learn slowly and can only learn through repetition. So I went out that very day and I worked on a 16-year-old mare who'd never been ridden and didn't like to be caught. She'd been a brood mare in Montana and had come down to Woodside, California. So they caught her up with a little bit of trouble, and then I started just moving her body in ways like moving her. I was looking for any way to move her body in a way that she couldn't do, but that would be acceptable to her. So I took her lips and I moved them around in her tail and her legs, which we'd been doing legs on horses for years because my husband and I wrote a book called Massage and Physical Therapy for the Athletic Horse that was first published in 1965. So that was not new to us. But we never thought about doing it with the idea of activating unused neural pathways to the brain. So we did this, and, you know, after about 45 minutes, this mare was standing there very quietly, and everybody watching me thought I'd hypnotized her. And I didn't think too much about it, so, cause, you know, I just went home. And the next morning, the owner called me and said, Linda, I don't know what you did to my horse. But when I went to catch her up later, instead of running for me, she came right to the gate. When I put her in the stall, instead of diving for her food, which she normally do, she kind of stood there next to me as if to say, that, like, do something, you know, do something to me. And that's when I started to work on horses' bodies from a really different point of view. However, I did that for 8 years, and I wrote my second book on the subject, and then I had an epiphany in 1983 when I was working on a really challenging mare at the Delaware Equine Center, a veterinary center back in Delaware, and nobody could figure out why this mare was in such pain. She hated to be touched. She hated to be groomed. She'd pin her ears or kick when you tried to saddle her. And these are really what really excellent veterinarians who were, in those days, stumped. So I put my hands on this mare with this very quiet Feldenkrais work, and she just got this dreamy look on her face. And her owner said, Linda, what are you doing? Are you using energy or, you know, what's your secret? Why is this horse so quiet, and why is she so accepting? And I intuitively said, don't worry what I'm doing. Put your hands on the horse and move the skin in a circle. And when I said that, I thought, oh, my gosh, okay, what does that mean? Because it's nothing to do with the Feldenkrais work. But I really have learned over the years, which is a whole other story, to trust my intuition and just listen to the guidance that I get. And to me, it's like a message from heaven. And she walked up and put her hands on this horse's shoulder and started doing these little tiny circles, just moving the skin gently in a circle. And the mare got as quiet for her as she was for me. And in that moment, that's when the Tellington T-Touch was born. And now I have 20 books in 13 languages. And we do it with all kinds of animals and people, and anybody can actually do these magic little circles and make a huge difference in your horse's attitude and behavior and health and performance, and that's what we do.
So there's a couple of things in that are really profound and important. One is that repetition of emotion isn't as important as we always thought, which goes counter to what we've learned as people trying to learn a new dance movement or to learn to play an instrument and things like that. But also this idea, and I want you to talk about that, but also this idea that doing a non-habitual motion in a new way without fear. What does that mean, a non-habitual motion?
It simply means moving your body in a way that you would not normally move it. And that's the beauty of the Feldenkrais work. But it's not what I actually do anymore. I left that in 1983, and I started really following these little circles. And the whole basis, the intention behind very gently moving the skin in a circle and a quarter is to activate the healing potential at the cellular level, to communicate at the cellular level in with appreciation to the body. Because when we send appreciation looking at an animal or at ourselves, we actually affect the health of that of those cells, of ourselves. And there's been such wonderful research from the Heart Math Institute and the International Institute of Biophysics. We just finished a four-day study in Vienna last month with 58 people showing how with these little circles done all over the body, you can increase cellular function. And this, the beauty of this work is that you can do it yourself, whether it's to your animals or to yourself. That's now, what keeps me passionate about, you know, running around the world teaching it.
Well, it turns out what you learned is that aggressive animals were usually animals with some pain or tension or other discomfort. How did you figure that out, and how did you start to deal with animals that most of us probably would have thought are too scary to work with?
Well, first of all, I had another one of those synchronistic experiences to which I pay a lot of attention, and that was actually in California again, and it was just a month after I started the Feldenkrais training. I went with a student to look at a new horse for her, and this horse, when he was brought out, was trotting around the ring with his ears pinned back, and so I said, well, thank you very much, you know, to the owner. It's really not what we were looking for. And she said, oh, but he never does that. So I had her pull the saddle, and you have to understand, I have a lifetime of experience of putting my hands on horses way before, you know, the Feldenkrais work because of this massage that we did with horses. And so when I ran my hands down his neck, I hit a spot, and the horse threw his head up and tried to bite, and it really scared him, and it was a really hot spot on his neck. And it sounds very strange to anybody who knows a lot in the horse world today, but I realized in that moment, and I've written a lot about it, that the pain caused the reaction and the fear and the resistance that the horse was putting. And it's so hard to believe because we've come so far now in the world of horses and other animals in realizing that resistance can be caused by pain or dis-ease or stress, big one, or fear, in addition to, of course, lack of communication. But I've been experiencing that and teaching it and realizing it for many, many years. And now we can find the places on the body where that fear or pain is present, and we can release it.
I would imagine that when you're teaching this to people, they have to learn to deal with their own fear or their own anger, maybe at their animal, because, of course, the animals can pick up on that. How do you work with people?
Well, you know something? I had the great fortune to learn, because in years past, I mean, until 25 years ago, if a dog or an animal or horse did something I didn't like, I'd get after it like everybody else did. And I've gotten after plenty of horses for being aggressive. But I had the good fortune to do that year-long course. Do you know the Course in Miracles?
I've heard of it.
Really, you can go online and see it. I mean, Oprah had Marianne Williams taught it. You can get it all over the country. It's a wonderful course, and part it's for people. And part of that, the teaching in that course, is that aggression comes from a place of fear and is a cry for help. And when I read that, I thought of all the dogs over the years that I had punished for being aggressive, or horses that I'd gotten after for pinning their ears or kicking. And I just had a whole other way of dealing with it, and that's what we deal with people. It's not that a person shouldn't be afraid, because fear is really protective, too. But the point is that we give people a way to deal with their fear without being aggressive toward the animal. And of course, we have another basic principle, and that is that understanding a behavior does not excuse it, but we don't punish for it. We find ways that are safe for the person working with the horse or the dog or other animals to be able to show the animal what we want so they can understand it and then are able to do it when that's possible.
We're talking to Linda Tellington-Jones. If I may insert a tiny bit of my own experience here, I have three dogs, and one of them gets aggressive toward the other ones from time to time. And for a while, I was trying to punish it. And then I just thought, you know, why don't I just restrain the dog without hurting it in my arms and on my lap and speak softly to it and explain to it that it didn't need to be scared or aggressive? And it always works. And he calms down, and I scratch his head, and I scratch his cheeks a little bit, and he loves it. And it just seems like it works better than spanking him and putting him in a room by himself, which is what I was doing before.
Good for you. Because we can show an animal what we want. And by doing that and making them comfortable and managing the situation, which is what you did, we can change behavior. And, of course, in situations where you get multiple dogs together, we need to learn how to manage them so that they are not threatened or have to get aggressive with another dog or tend to get aggressive. And there's a lot of management involved, as you well know, with three dogs.
Well, and I wanted to ask you, I mean, I hired a dog trainer once, and it didn't work very well because he was very, I don't know, it was a personality thing. It just was like he probably worked better with other types of people than me, but he was very focused on the concept of making me, the dog owner, the alpha. How does your work speak to this whole concept of the alpha member of the pack?
Oh, it's so boring. And it's so inaccurate. I mean, I'm just, this whole thing of having to be the alpha member, the alpha dog in a pack can be a leader with kindness. I mean, it's just doesn't mean being aggressive, and there's been so much misunderstanding of that. You, as you have found now, it sounds like with your dog, it's not that we don't lay the ground rules, but we do it without dominance, and that is a real difference. And I believe that we need this in our world today. There is so much idea that we have to make animals submit, and that's how we deal with a lot of people, isn't it? And when we change that attitude and we come, what we do in our trainings, and I have many, many teachers around the world who teach this work, and I'm not the only one that teaches, I'm one of many. We have many instructors who teach these courses, and my concept of this work is that when you come with animals from a place of understanding and forgiveness and tolerance and gratitude for these animals in our lives, and compassion, that we learn to be that way with ourselves and with our fellow beings. And that makes a difference on the planet. And that's my interest in this world.
One of the ways that you work with animals that are very difficult and, for example, unapproachable, like a feral cat or an animal that's extremely distressed or in pain, is that you use wands or long feathers to stroke them from a distance. Tell us about that.
Well, we put them in a situation where we're not actually getting our hands on them, but if you can visualize, first of all, just with intention, doing little strokes or circles as soon as we can get to that point from a distance, what we find is that you can calm them so much faster once you actually get that little... You can use anything that has like a soft end on it. We use all kinds of things to wrap them and then roll, because we work a lot with animals in shelters, you know, feral cats in shelters or wild bunnies who don't like to be touched. And the whole secret of it is from a distance first, you can just imagine it, not facing them, however, standing sideways to them so you're not staring at them. And then start with the feathers or the wands and start doing these little circular touches on them, and pretty soon you overcome their fear and you give them an opportunity to be with us in a way that they actually enjoy.
There is not only the touch, but also the tone of voice that you use with the animals.
Yes, toning makes a big difference. And it's not just the touch. We also, of course, have the work that we do with people also. We just don't have them lie down on the table and be T-touched. They move through labyrinths. We work with horses and dogs and people through labyrinths, and with horses and dogs through all kinds of different obstacles that we call the playground for higher learning, because this is where they learn a new balance. And when we talk about balance, we talk about not just physical, but mental and emotional balance. And that is the influence, like working through the labyrinth, that's the influence of the Feldenkrais idea of moving in non-habitual ways and moving in balance.
There's also, when you are touching the animals and speaking with them and or using tone, as you call it, you are aware of your own breath, and it sounds like meditation in the way that you use the breath to ground yourself and to become aware of what you're doing as well as aware of the other animal.
Well, it's not only that, it's also intention. It's about holding the picture of how you want your animal to be. Because one of the things that I find in all my trainings is that people have a great tendency, how whatever that animal, cat, dog, horse, rabbit, doesn't matter what it is, however they are, that's how they are described by that behavior. And if you start to hold the potential for how you would like that behavior to be, you can actually affect it. And there is a wonderful little book that I just, it's one of my, it's like a Bible to me. It's called Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer by Greg Braden. And in it, he describes so beautifully how holding that intention of how we, the emotion of how we will feel when, like for instance, when your dog no longer is at all aggressive toward the other dogs, that your dog is happy to be with the other dogs, that you can affect the behavior. And if you add to that these little circular touches so that you give a new level of confidence and awakening the intelligence and the function at the cellular level, that's what the Tellington Tea Touch does. And it's like a homeopathic intent in every little circle and a quarter, which is what we do. You put your fingers on your, or your hands very softly on your animal, and you move the skin in one circle and one quarter. If you do more than two circles, it doesn't work the same at all. And so you really have to be mindful, and that's where it is like a meditation, because it's the mindfulness of making simply the roundness and softness and rhythmical movement of those circular movements that you have to stay like fully present in doing it. So it's like a wonderful space to find that stillness that gives you a level of well-being that you'll find from being with your animal in this way. And I really pay attention to my breath. I do a lot of this deep like breathing into the nose and, you know, long, long, slow breaths out through lips, like blowing, lightly blowing a balloon. And that gives, that oxygenates my cells and my body and really affects the animal.
I was surprised to read that you do some of the Tellington Touch, the movements on the animal's lips and mouths and gums. And you do this even on wild felines and animals. I don't think I would probably put my fingers near their mouth.
It depends if it's safe or not. But we do a lot of work around the mouth and the gums, because moving the mouth and gums affects the part of the system, the emotional centers of the brain, that is formerly referred to as the limbic system. It's kind of an old-fashioned name now, but that's still, we know what that means. It's the part of the brain that controls our emotions, and it's the center for learning. And you know how, if you ever noticed, if your people are a little bit, if they're thinking or they're nervous, if nobody's watching them, they'll take their lips between their thumb and forefinger and move their lips. Have you ever noticed that?
I'll look for that.
Well, look for it, because it's a natural thing to do. But most children are taught by their mothers, don't keep your hands away from your mouth because your hands are probably dirty. And the fact is, that is an intuitive calming effect on you. It's a great thing for a person to do if they're nervous or if they're thinking, because it really helps to activate that part of the brain that from, you know, our center for learning. So, or if you're nervous, same thing. And it's really, really interesting, because I've suggested to people, you know, if they're angry, if they get angry, work their lips And a couple of times, I mean, when I suggested that a person would try it when they start to lose their temper and they can't touch their mouth because it's like, man, it's not the time. So what you do, you practice that. If you have a tendency to lose your temper, you practice that when you're calm. And I have the sweetest little story. A number of years ago, I was doing a television show for Kids TV Express in Austin. And that evening, there's a bunch of children. And that evening, I gave a presentation to a number of kids, including some six-year-olds. And I worked with a kitten who was quite aggressive in this family where I was visiting because the kids had teased her. And so I calmed her by just gently containing her. We don't restrain them. We contain them on the shoulders and then started doing these little touches. And then I got a little damp Q-tip, and I started touching her, gums with it because it wasn't safe with my fingers because of her biting. And then she got really calm. And I got a phone call from one of the mothers the next morning saying that on her way home she'd asked her six-year-old son, you know, did he like the evening and what had he learned? And he said, well, he decided that after watching me work with this kitten who had a tendency to get aggressive, that the next time he lost his temper, instead of breaking his toys, he was going to work his lips.
Oh, my goodness.
That's what kids can learn so well from this.
We're talking to Linda Tellington-Jones. Tell us about your experience working once again at the Zurich Zoo that started you down this path in some ways, with the little snow leopard there.
Oh, you know, it's so interesting. Actually, the little snow leopard that we're talking about was 9 months old at the time, and her body alone was a good 2.5 feet long, not counting the tail. And this was, it's actually in the foreword, written by the foreword in one of my books by the head vet for the Zurich Zoo, Dr. Professor Ewald Isenbugel. And these two young snow leopards had a undiagnosable respiratory problem, and they were dying. And I've known Dr. Isenbugel since he graduated from vet school. And so he asked me, I was there giving a presentation that evening to vet students at the University of Zurich Vet School. And so he asked me to look at these two snow leopards. And the keeper picked the snow leopard up and brought her out. And I sat down and took her on my lap. And I started doing these little tiny, tiny circles, starting from her nostrils, which with every breath, there was bubbling bloody mucus with every breath. And so I just started from her nose all the way to her tail, doing these just connected circles down her body in long lines. And I was so into what I was doing, I wasn't even paying attention to Dr. Isenbugel or the zookeeper standing there. And after I finished the whole thing, which took about 25 minutes, I put her back. And the whole time I had been watching her sibling watch me, and just visualizing that she was feeling the touches, and she had a break. Both of them had a breakthrough in the next hour, and the fever was broken, and they were fine. And I've got pictures now later of Dr. Isenbugel just against the fence, where he would stand there, and they would come up and kind of scrunch a little their face as he gave them an injection. He didn't even have to go in with them, and that was a really incredible experience. And one of the things we find with these little circular touches is we have many, many veterinarians in many countries who recommend the work for their clients because you can help to improve and enhance well-being with the touches. Or in cases like this, you can help the body to heal itself.
A lot of the work addresses behavior problems, some of which we've been talking about. If an animal is having a behavior problem, for example, I have a good friend whose cat will urinate on her clothes if it's angry at her for going away for a couple of days or something like that, or dogs that are barking too much. Do you have to do the touch and respond to the dog's behavior problem right when it happens?
No, you don't have to. And in the case of the cat, this is where I would suggest that she do very gentle circular touches over the entire cat and explain to the cat why she has to go, when she's coming back, and that this behavior has to change. And just to be really, you know, clear about that, because I've known of, I don't know, lots of cases where people really said, listen, you know what, this is not acceptable, and you're going to have to change, otherwise you can't be here. And combined with the touches, and by giving the animal the real level of connection that they desire, when I believe they do that and punish you in this way. And sometimes it can be, I mean, I just was talking to somebody yesterday, I can't remember exactly what it was, but I think it was a dog who slept on their bed all the time, throwing up on the bed every time they leave. I mean, in this case, it may not be intentional. The dog may be stressed, and she's going to sleep there. And so that's a different thing from what the cat is, you know, what the cat's doing. Because I don't know about you, but I certainly have had cats who wanted to punish me. I love it. I mean, they are so much smarter than many people give them credit for. So you talk to them about it. Make clear pictures so they understand, you know, where you're at and what has to happen. But by adding the circular touches to it makes a huge, huge difference, because the Tellington tea touch is it's like an interspecies communication without words. It's a special language without words.
There are a lot of people who have dogs, including me, who bark at anything in the yard. And, you know, you can get them to stop barking, but on the other hand, you want them to bark at evil intruders, just not at every leaf that falls onto the ground. Are dogs able to, can you train them to make those distinctions?
You can educate them to make the distinctions, I believe. First of all, I think every dog needs a job. And so if you want them to bark at the postman, what I do, I mean, I have a terrier, so you can imagine she's a Westie, and she likes to look over the balcony, and, you know, as far as she can see is her terrain. So she warns us when anybody does anything in the neighborhood. So I say, I let her bark, like she barks a couple of times, maybe two or three times. I say, thank you very much, Rainy, got it. That's good. Come here. And she gets, when she comes and sits down, and she, in the beginning, gets a treat. She doesn't need that anymore at all, but she gets her some tea touches, and thank you for warning us. But there is no question in my mind, but that you, with a clarity, that you can get teach your dogs what you expect of them, and then reward them with your voice. And we don't use only food reward. Man, oh, man, I'm telling you, in the training world, I just find it really interesting that there's so many dogs who are trained only to food, and if you don't have food, they don't listen to you. That, to me, is not education. It's like bribery, and it doesn't work so well in the long run.
Very interesting. Now, what about dog behaviors that are absolutely natural in the wild, but you don't want them to do it, such as chasing the neighbor's cat?
I think that's education and also management. And, you know, when we first introduced when we got our Westie, she was 5 months old, and I had her on leash, and I had her with a cat, because I was told that don't ever let her off leash by a cat. Westies will all kill cats. What an amazing statement. So what I did was have her on leash with a cat who was not afraid of dogs, and we brought her up and introduced her, and she was, you know, like, came up, and this cat gave her a little bat on the nose, and Rainy jumped back, and I said, no, just got to be nice to this kitty. And that was our first weekend, and we just really watched the two of them. And as a matter of now, her best friend is a cat. And it's a question of management. You have to find, you can't let them out where they can chase it. And there's a caveat here, because if a dog has already gone after a cat and killed it, that's up to you to protect that cat, because I don't know that you can do anything. But our interest is in educating dogs to know that, wait a minute, you know what? You've got to be reasonable with cats. They can be your friends. This is part of the family. So we bring them, and we do tea touches on both of them together. And we have a lot of success with this, actually. And anybody who's interested can go to our website and just look up Tillington Tea Touch. There are so many blogs around. There's rteatouch.com has lots of stories on it. And we have many practitioners around the country who are doing some wonderful blogs telling about all kinds of stories that they're, you know, situations like this and behaviors that they're changing.
One thing that's important and perhaps useful for people is when they have an injured animal or an animal who's in shock, you can use that form of touch either on the way to the vet or before the vet comes.
Yes, it's the ear work, and we've been doing it for more than 25 years, and we have hundreds and hundreds of cases. If your animal is injured on your way to the vet, or if it's like a horse and you're waiting for the vet, you stroke the ears. It's a circle at the base and a slide out to the tip of the ear, and you just keep doing this gently over the whole ear, because around the base of the ear affects the digestive and respiratory system, and in the whole ear are connections to the entire body. And we have so many really remarkable cases where animals were said to have no chance of living, and they came through. And actually, it works exactly the same way. We do it with people, with the entire ear, while you're waiting to get to a doctor or getting medical help in an emergency.
It really is striking the way in which, if you think about this and get into it, it can be applied to human beings. The idea that cooperation is not only the most joyous, but also the most natural and effective way of being with other animals and other people, that's profound. I mean, we could end wars if we internalized that.
That's true. That's the whole idea. You know, the thing that I love is the fact that thanks to the understanding now of quantum physics, that every thought, feeling, emotion, and belief that we have does affect the entire quantum field, that each time we reach out to our animals or our own species, we, with kindness and with appreciation, we do make a difference.
Linda Tillington-Jones is a trainer and teacher, the author of 20 books, and she's teaching a couple of workshops in the Santa Fe area for horses and for dogs. People can call 505-455-2945 for more information. Linda, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it was a great pleasure, and I look forward to meeting you and meeting your dog in a couple of weeks.
Wonderful.
You keep up your good work.
Thank you, and you too. We'll see you here in Santa Fe.
Thanks so much.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Janet Gotkin. She is with the Santa Fe chapter of NOW, the National Organization for Women. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
And you are co-organizing an event called, or a series of events called, Santa Fe Women's Film Series, Before There Was Choice. And the first event is actually a film that's being shown tonight at the Santa Fe Community College. We'll talk about that in a moment. But this is a film series about reproductive choice and birth control and abortion and family planning and all of that stuff as it's dramatized in the movies. Why'd you decide to do that now?
Well, we felt it was really important in the current, with current challenges to abortion in this country, to create a place where we could talk about abortion, and possibly, hopefully, we could communicate to young women what it was like in this country when abortion was not available, when it was illegal. So that was the thinking behind creating this series of iconic and outstanding women's films that deal with abortion and reproductive rights.
What was it like in this country before abortion was legal?
Well, it was a pretty horrifying scenario. If you were a wealthy woman and you wanted to terminate your pregnancy, you could go to Europe or you could go to Canada and you could get a safe abortion. Otherwise, it was the back alley abortion. Women died of self-induced abortions. They died of dirty, illegal abortions. It was a horrifying time for women. And we hope never to go back to that in this country. One of our concerns is that abortion became legal in this country through the Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade in 1973. But women born since then are in many cases not aware of what that was like. And that was, we're hoping to show this and create an atmosphere where we can talk about abortion and undemonize it, unshame it, so that we could really begin to discuss with young women what their options are.
I mean, I think it's important to remember that abortion is a backup for other kinds of birth control, and as long as other kinds of birth control are readily available and young women and men understand them, maybe learn in school or learn wherever they can learn about these things, abortion becomes less necessary.
Absolutely. But, you know, there's an attack on birth control as well. During the Bush years, the only funding for reproductive planning, so to speak, was abstinence-only programs. And actually, under Obama, they're still being funded to a certain extent, which is pretty horrifying.
They so don't work.
But there's a lot of pressure on the religious right for abstinence-only. And in actuality, in women's lives, I don't really remember what the number is, but 1 in 4 women or possibly 1 in 3 is going to experience an unwanted pregnancy because things happen. Birth control fails. So it's really important to have this, to have access to emergency contraception, and to remember that still abortion is a legal medical procedure in this country, as much as it's been demonized over the last 25 years.
And as we know and have discussed on this program, unwanted pregnancies that result in new people on this planet often also result in child and women's poverty.
No question. We're in New Mexico. We are a rural state. We are a poor state. And poor women are unduly challenged when it comes to health in general and reproductive health. We're also very fortunate in New Mexico that we have a Medicaid funding for abortion as part of our state law. We also have an Equal Rights Amendment in New Mexico, which is quite extraordinary. But poor women are challenged. The only two counties in New Mexico where you can get an abortion are Santa Fe and in Albuquerque. So women have to travel long distances. One of our secondary purposes to this film series is to raise money for a new venture between Santa Fe Now and the New Mexico Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. This is a fund called the Pro-Choice Safety Network Fund. We're going to be raising money and hope to do some through these films as a start to help low-income women pay for non-medical expenses like transportation, a bus ticket if you're coming from Farmington, an overnight stay if you're here from Las Cruces, meals, babysitting expenses, and so on. Right now, nothing is really covering that, and we're hoping to create that and siphon that money through the abortion providers, through Planned Parenthood, through the Religious Coalition.
Now, tonight, the film that's being shown at the Santa Fe Community College is called Vera Drake, and afterwards there will be... What time is that at?
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock at the community college. And after that, there will be a discussion which will be led by Elizabeth Buchan, who is a doctor, and she's also the director of women's health policy at the Southwest Women's Law Center.
Yes, Elizabeth is a wonderful, interesting woman who worked in direct medical reproductive health services for quite a number of years in Santa Fe and Albuquerque, and now is working with the Southwest Women's Law Center. She's going to be introducing Vera Drake, and she's going to be facilitating a discussion afterwards of some of the issues that are raised. Vera Drake is an extraordinarily wonderful movie. Imelda Staunton got an Oscar nomination for it. It's a very, very moving portrait of a woman, working-class woman in England in the 1950s, who finds herself helping poor women end their pregnancies and ends up in a lot of trouble afterwards. Kind of.
Janet Godkin is with the Santa Fe chapter of NOW. If people want more information, what is the email to reach you?
It's info@nowsantafe.org.
Janet Godkin, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.